correct me so that it is only looking at reflective signal, not the forward going signal. You therefore are looking at all of the echoes in the room around you when you aim the horn at various objects. Set the directional port into a spectrum analyzer or some other high dynamic range display device. Let me try. And it's very interesting to wave this thing around the room. It constitutes a CW radar. No pulsing is required. The transmitter runs continuously. You see very little of the transmitter signal. You see only the signal that is being reflected from the objects in the room as you wave the horn around the room or as people move in front of you. Very exciting display to look at. And how in the world they designed something that across the whole damn bandwidth of 8.4 gigahertz to 12.4 gigahertz, it has 50 decibels of directivity. It took a very exotic set of holes between the two pieces of waveguide that are broad wall coupled to each other. And it also has on the coupled waveguide a sort of a serpentine device. It looks like an inchworm where the waveguide goes up for a short distance and comes right back down again. This $2 item, boy, have I gotten my money's worth out of it. I've made some very interesting measurements over the years. I've shown it to many of the microwave people I work with and ask them, what do you think you're looking at? And many of them will say, gee, I think it's a filter, I think it's a hybrid, I think it's a monopulse radar beamforming network. They had all kinds of guesses as to what it is. It is, to some degree, a simple directional coupler. I think it was manufactured in the late 60s before real good computer modeling came along. And so how did some little old microwave engineer know where to put all of these holes, very precise size and placement of holes that couple the signal from one piece of transmission line to the other that are inside of this waveguide-type directional coupler? And by the way, waveguide directional couplers differ an awful lot from coaxial directional couplers in that they are co-directional instead of counter-directional. For a whole bunch of crazy reasons in physics, when it comes to putting coupled lines close to each other in a coaxial structure, the coupled signal always flows in the wrong direction, the backwards direction. That's why it's called a counter-directional coupler. Most of the waveguide couplers, the signal that flows from waveguide 1 into the coupled line, waveguide number 2, flows in the same direction, co-directional couplers, just the way the physics works. So you'd be amazed how many books will get that wrong. We'll show you the schematic diagrams of how to hook up directional couplers, and sometimes they got a backwards termination on one side and output connector on the other for the auxiliary line, and they hook it up as a co-directional, not as a counter-directional, because they misunderstand, the guy who wrote the diagram misunderstands that. So as I was starting to say, you didn't have real good computer modeling in the late 60s when this thing was invented, and yet still very precisely made with these holes, and it wasn't something that was carefully tuned on manufacture. I can tell by looking at this thing that they were stamping these things out like cookie cutters. Once they had a good design, they just built a whole lot of them. I bought two of them at this flea market. My good friend Paul Wade, W1 Gigahertz, GHZ, bought another two of them, and they look identical. So the company who built these things really knew how to do it, and some little old engineer really understood how that wave feels when it goes down that waveguide in order to properly set up these holes in order to get this extremely high directivity of a 20 dB coupling coefficient directional coupler.
Repeater, timeout.
At many flea markets, directional couplers sell for very inexpensive prices, like $10. Even though brand new, they might be $1,000. Quite often, they've got type N connectors on them, sometimes 3 millimeter SMA connectors. But type N connectors are one of the most popular kind. Nodder is a very popular brand. I'm trying to think of some of the other brand names of directional couplers that I've used. The company that makes the so-called Zinger printed circuit-like directional coupler. All of a sudden, I'm having trouble thinking of their name. They make some very nice couplers that have extremely high performance across an octave. And as I said, at flea markets, they sell for rather inexpensive prices because most people don't know what they are. You can take a directional coupler that's designed for some ridiculously high frequency, like 2 to 4 gigahertz. You can set it in series with your particular transmission line on your 80-meter transmitter. and it will allow you to take a sample in a non-invasive manner of what's going on in your transmission line. You can use them far outside of their rated frequency region if you're going down in frequency. You can use them at higher frequency. They don't explode. They just lose their directivity. But a well-designed directional coupler, when they talk about the frequency region like 2 to 4 gigahertz, that is the frequency region over which the coupled line is a quarter wavelength long. The magic of what happens inside of a directional coupler is you get maximum coupling coefficient between your main line and the auxiliary line when the auxiliary line is a quarter wavelength long. That's just the way they work. You get maximum coupling there. And if you plotted coupling versus frequency on a graph, it would look like a rectified sine wave. At 0 megahertz, you get no coupling. At a quarter wavelength, you get maximum coupling. That's the peak of the rectified sine wave. At twice the frequency, where it's a half wave long, it comes back down to a null again, and the process keeps repeating as you go up in frequency. But only the first lump of that curve, frequency versus response, do you have directivity. And as you go down in frequency, the coupling coefficient falls off like a rectified sine wave, S-I-N wave. So once you know that, and you know the quarter wave...
Repeater, timeout.
Quarter wavelength is where you get maximum coupling. That's where you're taking the sine of 90 degrees, because 90 degrees is one quarter of 360 degrees. It represents 90 degrees of length, or one quarter wavelength. And so if you use it at half the frequency where it is rated, where you would be taking the sine of 45 degrees, which is 0.707, which means you would be 3 decibels, 0.707 in voltage, which is half power, because 0.707 squared, remember, power is voltage squared over R, at half the frequency, it will have 3 decibels more coupling loss, so to speak. If it was a 10 dB coupler at the design frequency, and you're using it at half the frequency, it's going to become 3 dB more, or a 13 dB coupler instead of a 10 dB coupler. But if it was well designed, it still has the high directivity. It favors the signal in one direction over the other. At first, it seems to be a violation of reciprocity. Let me drop. The fact that the magic of a directional coupler is that it can sample the signal that flows on your transmission line in one direction, but essentially thoroughly reject any signal flowing on the line in the opposite direction. Seems to be kind of magic. Hybrids can do that. A directional coupler really is a kind of a hybrid. The hybrid you've got inside of an ordinary acoustic telephone allows you to hear a small sample of what you're sending out from the mouthpiece. It's called the side tone. In other words, you know that the telephone is active because you hear a small sample of your voice in the earpiece. It's a hybrid that's doing that. It's a kind of directional coupler. Once you understand the principle of operation, there are ways of making directional couplers at audio frequencies, with toroids and things like that. It's fairly simple. If you look at the ARRL antenna book, there is a kind of a bridge, or what would you call it now, power sampling, visual meter, that you can homebrew by way of using toroids and the proper kind of terminations, where the main center conductor of your transmission line flows down the center of the toroid, right through the hole of the donut, so to speak, and the wiring that you put on the toroid itself is the pickup coil that monitors the current flowing down that piece of coax cable. And with proper terminating of that winding that's on the donut, on the toroid, you can make a directional coupler out of that. And as I said, one of the schematic diagrams in the ARRL antenna book will show you how to do that. Now, as I said, one article that gives you a medium good explanation of how directional couplers work, as I said, just happens to be in the February 2009 issue of Wireless Design and Development. That's the name of one of these freebie electronic magazines, Wireless Design and Development. If you want to go to a website, I haven't done it, but I guarantee if you Google the word directional coupler plus the word Wikipedia, guarantee they've got some nice explanations on that. I published, let's see, 10 or 12 articles on the microwave reflector. Let me drop. over the last few years, I would put various articles that I thought people, the microwave enthusiasts, would like to know about. I put them on this listserv of Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha, has this listserv of about 250 or 400 people who are serious microwave enthusiasts worldwide, and they share information with each other. From time to time, I put articles on there where I said, hey, this is a better way to do it. And there's an extremely progressive group of microwave enthusiasts in North Texas called the The Roadrunners Microwave Group, RMG. Roadrunner Microwave Group, K5RMG. Kilo 5 Romeo Mike Golf. If you go to the website of www.kilo5romeomikegolf.org, that's the Roadrunners Microwave Group, that's what RMG stands for, and you go to their technical section, you will find something called the Dick Nadel Corner, K2RIW Corner. The very first article there of the 10 articles is called 3-centimeter directional couplers. Directional couplers used for measuring standing wave ratio. There's an article there telling you a little bit about how they work, how to use them, how to calibrate one, and how to make it work better, and how to use it out of the desired frequency range, out of the designed frequency range, and how to calculate exactly what performance you're going to get. So in other words, you're standing at a flea market. Let me drop. On the bench in front of you is a directional coupler made from 8 to 12 gigahertz. And the average guy who's an HF operator is going to say, boy, that's a zillion times higher in frequency than I ever intend to go to. Well, you as an HF operator, if you paid the $3 or whatever the guy is selling the darn thing for, because nobody knows what it is, maybe it's $10, maybe it's $20, it's worth it. You pay the couple of dollars that he's selling this thing for, and you take it home, and you connect this 8 to 12 gigahertz directional coupler in line with your 80-meter antenna. That will allow you to take a sample of what's going on your 80-meter antenna. You could measure the visual with that very conveniently. And there you're using it way far outside of the frequency range. When you're taking the sine of that 90 degrees, in that case you're going to be taking the sine of 1 degree, because maybe you're 90 to 1 lower in frequency, if you know what I mean. And so you would get a predictable amount of performance. So if you go to that article at www.k5rmg.org/tech.html, or just go to k5rmg.org, and on their main page you'll see technical topics. And you go to the technical topics, the bottom of that page, you'll see the K2RIW corner. And of the 10 articles there, the top article is on the use of directional couplers. There's probably 4,000 words in that article that some people appreciate, because it tells them how to use directional couplers, how to get more performance out of them, how to use them far outside of the frequency range. And so this very effective device is so darn inexpensive. The average electronic engineer has only a slight understanding of what it does and how it works. And if you want, in a couple of sentences, where is the directivity coming from? How does it favor the signal in one direction versus the other direction? I'll give you a couple of sentences on that. Let me drop. Your auxiliary line, which in the best coupling situation is a quarter wavelength long, your auxiliary line lies parallel to the main line on your coaxial cable. That's what's going on inside the directional coupler. And whether you build it with round coaxial cables like the monomatch with the piece of enameled wire inside, or whether you build it as a strip line or microstrip structure where you've got flat lines lying parallel to each other over the ground plane, the method of construction to some degree doesn't matter. But the main characteristic is that the directional pickup line, the auxiliary line as I'm calling it, lies parallel to the main line. Therefore, two things are happening. Because it lies in the vicinity and parallel to the main center conductor of your coax cable, there is capacitive coupling between the two. The capacitive coupling means that the left side and the right side of the auxiliary line are picking up essentially the same voltage. They're just two parallel wires and capacitively coupled. They both pick up the same voltage, so to speak. However, simultaneously, that auxiliary line is in the magnetic field as current flows in the main center conductor of the transmission line going down the center of your directional coupler. As current flows through that line, it sets up a magnetic field similar to the right-hand rule. The right-hand rule means you pick up the piece of wire in your hand, your thumb points in the forward direction where the current is flowing, your fingers wrap around the wire, your fingers represent the direction that the magnetic field is created around that wire because current is flowing through that wire. All right, that magnetic field flowing in the main line is also being picked up by the auxiliary line. It's picking up some of that magnetic field. The magnetic field that is coupling the primary line to the auxiliary line represents a transformer. The primary line is the primary winding of the transformer. Let me drop. The auxiliary line is a secondary winding of this flat transformer. And yeah, there's no magnetic structure. There's no EI laminations in between. At microwave frequencies, at RF frequencies, you don't need that. Don't worry about it. So the transformer action is creating a voltage pickup on the auxiliary line where the left side is positive and the right side is negative, in my example, in voltage. So the capacitive coupling gives you the same voltage on left side and right side. Let me call it plus and plus. The magnetic coupling gives you a differential voltage on the auxiliary line, positive on the left side, negative on the right side. Mother Nature takes these two effects and adds them together. You get a plus from capacitive coupling and a plus from magnetic coupling on the left-hand side of the auxiliary wire. You get a plus from the capacitive coupling and a negative from the magnetic coupling on the right-hand side. Plus and minus cancels. So no voltage is picked up on the right-hand side, but voltage is on the left-hand side for a signal that is flowing on the main line left to right. That's directivity. When you get the right layout of the line and or the right terminating resistance on the auxiliary line, what you're literally doing is adjusting the ratio of the capacitive coupling versus the magnetic coupling. Therefore, you're creating a null performance on the right-hand side and a peaking of performance on the left-hand side. That gives you a little bit of feeling for what you're doing when you adjust various load resistors on the auxiliary line. You're really adjusting the nulling performance that you and I call directivity. That's where it's coming from. Once you understand the principle, it's not so magic. What it does is kind of magic. To me, it's almost half as magical as what goes on in an antenna when it radiates. So do at your leisure read this article from the K5RMG.org Roadrunners Microwave Group in Northern Texas, and it'll give you a lot more understanding. The next time you're at a flea market and somebody is selling a directional coupler, don't turn up your nose at those darn things. Don't run away from it, even though it's not rated for your frequency range. It's an extremely healthy, handy item in many experiments where...
Repeater, time out.
In many experiments where you want to take a sample of what's going on a transmission line. Without interfering with the normal operation of the transmission line, you can take a small sample and find out what signal is flowing forward, what signal is flowing in reverse. Once you understand the directional coupler, you'll understand how your bird wattmeter works. You'll understand a little bit why you can use the bird slugs far outside of their frequency range, but they're going to fall off in a certain way in performance, and you can predict that. You'll also understand that almost anything that you adjust for a nulling performance, there's a certain frequency region over which you get that null, unless you... unless you've done something a little bit more exotic. And therefore, you're going to lose directivity of your slug, of your bird wattmeter, if you use it far out of the frequency range. On top of that, if you're really doing a fine tuning of your antenna and you want the standing wave ratio to be 1.01 to 1, don't fall into the trap of putting a kilowatt out of the transmitter and using the kilowatt slug to look at forward power and then use the 100 milliwatt slug for looking at the reverse power. You can't do that. You've got to keep the exact same slug, even though it's hard to read the needle way down at the bottom end. Because of finite directivity of that slug, and because the two slugs maybe don't match each other. There are people who fall into that trap of trying to get a more precise measurement, and you may be damaging the equipment because there's a terminating resistor inside of that slug for the signal that flows in the wrong direction. And when you're putting a kilowatt for a slug that's rated for 100 milliwatts or 1 watt full scale, and even though you're using the slug in the reverse direction and you think you're protecting it, well, you're protecting the meter movement, but you're not protecting the internal resistor. So there's some physics here you got to be familiar with. There's a little bit of a discussion giving you guys any questions. If so, give Mel and Dick your questions right now. And give me your call letters and name. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW.
TJJ.
Okay, Eric and Doug in that order. Anyone else? That's more than enough. That's more than enough. Eric, you got the floor.
All right, well, your little discussion reminds me of something that I did a few years back. I essentially took two ferrite cores and wound myself. I had a particular application in mind. I wound two sets of transformers using the right-hand rule, all oriented in the same direction. I actually kind of saw it out as a three-port device, really a four-port device, the fourth port being the load resistor to ground. And basically the way I wired it up is the main signal through the, if you want to put polarities on it, the plus side of the primary winding, leading out, and the secondary side had the windings connected reverse, was the plus side of the secondary of the first transformer hooked up to the minus side of, say, the primary side of the second transformer, and then according to which way you make the auxiliary connection, you could either have it be inverting or non-inverting. And then using Kirchhoff's laws of both voltage and current, you can actually figure out the actual current flow through each particular node. It was a different kind of application than, say, like a bird watt meter, but the way you talked about it snaking through the coax, the shield of the coax, just kind of brought that whole thought back to my head, and it's just, it took me a while to do the calculations, but I actually was able to determine the amount of current, what the coefficient was for the coupling, and what the actual return losses were on the couple port, and the input port, and the output port. I probably could have gone out and just bought myself a little thing that he made and put together, but this was a very specific application. I was looking for a couple of loss of about 10 dB, and I think I actually came up with it and worked out fine, but it was just an interesting experiment.
What frequency were you at, and where was that application? If I understand correctly now, you used a toroid transformer with the right hookup, with the right kind of a terminating resistor, and you created, with lumped elements, a directional coupler. Most of the directional couplers I've been describing tonight are done with distributed elements. They're done with pieces of coax cable or a microstrip or strip line. You did it with a toroid transformer. What was the application, and what frequency were you at there, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, this was running at a TV channel, actually. This is up at 213, 212 in that neighborhood. And I chose the closed hunks of ferrite just because of the nice amount of mutual. I could have done it as air transformers, but the mutual inductance of the cores themselves and the fact that I needed really good bandwidth was the reason why I went this way.
Now, were you using this at the low level to monitor the drive signal to one of your transmitters, or were you putting this through a small opening, so to speak, in the waveguide or the transmission line that went to the antenna in order to sample what was going up the antenna? Where did you actually apply this, and what power level was it running at, Eric? Go ahead.
Now, this was low-level stuff. I was interested in doing some mixing of a couple of signals. Actually, trying to put an additional subcarrier, or an additional carrier within the TV bandwidth. This was just something that I was trying as an experiment with a friend of mine who was doing something in California. The power levels, I guess, were around a milliwatt or so. Nothing really intense, but it was important to try and create that isolation that we were looking for.
Sounds like fun. Okay, let's see how Doug has used directional compass or what he would like to discuss. K2JJ. All those Yonkers guys, look out for them. K2RAW in the TechNet.
All right, Dick, I just had a question on power handling capability. I've got a bunch of these little NARDA directional couplers. They're rated from 7 to 12.4 gigahertz. SMA connectors on them. The J3 port is minus 30 dB. Very small. They're maybe an inch and a half long by an inch wide. Any ideas to power handling capability?
Yeah, there's a way you can calculate that fairly easily, Doug. First of all, the fact that it's a 30 decibel directional coupler is a fancy way of saying whatever signal appears on the main straight-through ports, input and output port, sometimes called J1 and J2, of a directional coupler, that the signal that's on the auxiliary line inside, the J3, J4 port, will always be 30 dB down, regardless of direction. In one direction it's going into a termination, the other direction it's coming out your fourth port, but always 30 dB down. So, assuming now that the termination inside is good for, I'm going to pick a number, 1 watt, that would mean that 30 dB away from 1 watt is a kilowatt. That means, in theory, the straight-through line could be running a kilowatt, and the power picked up by the auxiliary line would not be exceeding the 1 watt, which is the maximum the termination inside can take. That's one quick calculation. Let me drop. However, there's a second calculation here required. The construction itself has a certain power limitation. Most likely this is a strip line inside, microstrip or a strip or a tri-plate strip line, and I hope that that carrier that's continuously in the background doesn't time us out. If so, Eric will make a correction to that. Each time I drop the carrier, we're not getting a resetting here. The next thing, limitation, is what can the directional coupler microstrip take, and my guess is it can take something close to 100 watts. The third limitation is what power can you put through an SMA connector. An SMA connector, a barefoot SMA connector, at a frequency of 7 to 12 gigs, can just barely take 50 watts. It'll run hot. 10 watts is safe. So your biggest limitation is the SMA connector itself. Guarantee the printed circuit board inside can take a lot more than the SMA connector can take. And the failure mechanism of an SMA connector is current flowing down the center pin. That's what overheats the pin of the mating portions of the connector, the male and female interface, and that overheating eventually will create failure if you run more than about 50 watts for any significant length of time. Now, you can also use duty factor in your favor. The SMA connector itself probably would not...
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, as I was saying, Doug, the semiconductor cannot take more than about 50 watts at that frequency range. So that's your major limitation. But you can see the step-by-step process by which you calculate first your internal termination, your PC board, and the connectors themselves. And so even though you don't have the data sheet of that device in front of you, you can make some darn good guesses within an order of magnitude as to what power level you can put through it. The SMA connector probably would not arc over before 5 kilowatts. In other words, if you were putting extremely brief pulses of a low duty factor through that directional coupler, very brief microsecond-like pulses, you could run to 5 kilowatts as long as the average power is low enough. But CW power, I wouldn't go beyond 50 watts. K2JJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2, QIQ.
Glenn recognized, but Doug first. Go ahead, Doug.
Okay, Dick, very good. Yeah, I wasn't thinking of using them up that high. It's interesting that we'll go down lower. I often have occasion to It'd be nice to take a sample at VHF, UHF, you know, 2 meters, 440 type frequencies, and have that that sample there. There is a fourth port on the device, which has a male SMA screwed in there. It looks like a terminating resistor of some type. So it couldn't be more than probably an eighth of a watt, I guess, is in there, something like that. I'll have to experiment a little bit, and I have a bunch of them here, so if we blow one up or two, no great loss. I didn't pay much for them, so they're brand new and sealed packages. But that was my my intent, Dick.
Yeah, start experimenting. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. One of the things you'll be disappointed about is that you look at all the available literature and try to find out what is the maximum power handling capability of each of the connectors we use, BNC, TNC, SMA, UHF, Type N, and so on. Nowhere will anybody tell you what is the maximum power you can put through one of those connectors. Talk to an experienced RF, Maven, ham radio operator. He can tell you how much power you can successfully put through each connector. But no data sheet will tell that to you. And I guess part of the fear is that it depends on the conditions. If you're using the connector at 60,000 feet where the air is very thin and easily arcs over in a dry atmosphere, you probably have one power rating, and maybe that's part of what they're worried about. You get very little airflow, so you're not getting very much cooling. Most connectors fail because of thermal overload of the center conductor. Over to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's a very interesting conversation here tonight, Dick. Just a quick question for you, though. If you use a directional coupler from the gigahertz air region down into, let's say, HF, obviously the coupling is going to become higher. So in other words, if you're starting off with like a 30 dB coupling in the microwave region, and you start going down to HF, the coupling is going to go up quite a bit. I'm not exactly sure. Maybe you got an answer for that one. But my other question is that, let's say if you have a 100-watt rated coupler or somewhere in that area, and you start off with like 30 dB of coupling, so, you know, with a 30 dB signal, you get plus 30 dBm signal, you wind up with a 0 dBm, you know, a milliwatt coming up the port, which is a nice ratio. But if you go, if you want to start winding up with like a 60 dB coupling or higher, the problem that you're running into is if it's only like a 100-watt coupler, like, it's going to take 60 dBm with 60 dB of coupling to give you a 1 milliwatt output out of that port. Do you have a feeling for, like, when you go that many octaves down, what kind of coupling you're going to wind up with? Because the coupler itself might just be too small. KC2QIQ.
Boy, do I have good news for you. It turns out the coupling you get as you go down in frequency is not a mystery. It is deterministic. It is calculatable. With your handheld calculator, you're going to do it. When you read the label on the directional coupler, let's say, for instance, I'm using one that's rated from 8 to 12 gigahertz, and this is an exact one that I used when I was testing a 300-watt transmitter for the article I had in 73 magazine, and this is part of that article at K5RMG. When you read it, you'll find out the details. I wanted to test a 300-watt output transmitter, but Jim Fisk wanted to know what was the second, third, and fourth harmonic out of that transmitter, because it was a strip line amplifier, tripler, transmitter. So when I'm setting it up for tripling from 144 to 432 megacycles, Jim Fisk said, how do you know how much power you're putting out at 880 megacycles? That's the second harmonic of 432, 864 megs, and so on. And so I go to my instrumentation room of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and they say, hand me a 30 dB directional coupler that can take 300 watts, to which he says, you're crazy, we ain't got one of those. We got nothing here that goes beyond a couple of watts. Well, I looked at what they got. And the 10 dB coupler they had that worked at 10 gigahertz, I was going to use it down at 1 gigahertz. One-tenth the frequency. Bear in mind now that the directional coupler has maximum coupling, usually it's rated coupling, where the directional line is a quarter wavelength long. Let me drop. Quarter wavelength long is 90 degrees in phase. 90 degrees is one quarter of 360 degrees. So, and the voltage picked up by a directional coupler as you go down in frequency follows a sine wave, S-I-N, trigonometric function. You know what the sine of 90 degrees is? Unity. You know what the sine of 45 degrees, half frequency, 0.707. That's the voltage pickup. Square that voltage and you'll get 0.5 power. 0.5 power is 3 dB extra loss. So when you use a directional coupler at exactly half the rated frequency, it will have 3 decibels of additional coupling coefficient. If it was a 10 dB coupler at 10 gigs, it's going to be a 13 dB coupler at 5 gigs. And you could work your way all the way down to DC. If they've done a good job of building the termination inside in a way that's broadband enough, the thing literally goes all the way down to DC. It's on your network analyzer or spectrum analyzer. You sweep a directional coupler and plot amplitude of coupled response versus frequency. It looks like a rectified sine wave on the screen. The peak of the sine wave of where it's 90 degrees long. The next valley is where it's 180 degrees long, halfway, twice the frequency of the rated front panel data sheet, so to speak. The bad thing about going beyond the first bump in the curve, the 0 to 180 degrees, is that the next bump in the curve between 180 and 360 does not have directivity. You're now using it at the three-quarter wave point instead of the one-quarter wave point on the coupled line. It no longer has directivity. But from the one-quarter wave point all the way down to DC, it falls off at exactly 6 dB per octave once you get away from the first octave or two. That's the way a sine wave falls off, by the way. If I take the sine of 5 degrees, the sine of 2.5 degrees, the sine of 1 and an eighth degrees, and so on, I'm falling off 6 dB per octave. So sine of small numbers do that. So you now can predict mathematically exactly what you're going to get. And you'll get 90-some-odd% accuracy with that prediction, and that's more than good enough. And then with the instrumentation you have access to, Glenn, you can do the last tenth of a degree, dB of calibration if you wish to do that. Both in
repeater, timeout.
Both in directivity and in coupling coefficient. So if I should run that by again, because I know I gave it to you kind of fast, go ahead and request it. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the SECNET.
No, that's a very good description, Dick, because when I was listening, you said the key word right there that I was looking for. I used to design them, and with the numbers, 6 dB per octave roll-off, and then, of course, as you said, after the first octave ripple, you start losing all your directivity in the coupler. Because I used to design them, you know, all over microwave power devices all the time. As a matter of fact, one of my biggest challenges was one for the Navy for the watt-meter calibration system, where I had a directional coupler that operated from about 500 kilohertz to 30 megahertz. Very interesting. They were actually calibrating their bird watt-meters, but with actually real full power. So, it's interesting. But, yeah, with some limitations and with some, some understanding of how the coupler is working, it can be used over some pretty wide ranges, yeah, even if it's not exactly one you're looking for. But you're right, to do the VSWR tricks and other things like that with the dual directivity isn't going to be all that good when you drop off below an octave or so. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, you're being a little bit pessimistic. If the coupler is well-designed, and the main difference, well-designed and not so well-designed, is how broadband is the 50-ohm termination that's built into it. And in some cases, that's an external device that you can replace. If the termination has broad enough frequency region as you go down in frequency, and that's the easy direction. If you're using a termination that's rated at 1 gig, and you happen to be using it at 10 megacycles, it's hard to make a 50-ohm termination that works well at 1 gig and suddenly dies at 10 megacycles. Almost everything gets better as you go down in frequency. So, under normal circumstances, a well-designed directional coupler keeps all of its directivity as you go down. The coupling coefficient falls off 6 dB per octave. So, if it is a 30 dB coupler at its design frequency, let's say it's a 10 dB coupler at its design frequency, and where you're using it, it is a 43 dB coupler, it'll still be a 43 dB coupler with 20 dB of directivity. It'll be 43 dB in the forward direction and 63 dB of loss in the reverse direction on the coupled line. It tends to keep its directivity. And if you're unhappy with the directivity you've got, making it perfect is easy. to do it in the most sophisticated way, you simply put a double subtuner on the output of the straight through line. And let me drop and I'll explain what's going on here. If a directional coupler is properly balanced for the coupling of the capacitive effect and the inductive effect, in the design phase, it really means you set up the proper Z odd and Z even. In other words, odd mode, differential mode is a certain impedance between the two lines, the straight through line and the auxiliary line. In the even mode, when you feed them together, there's a certain impedance that they have. So odd and even mode, when you set them up correctly, you have directivity. But even if you didn't do that, by adjusting the terminations on the auxiliary line, you can make the directivity better. But even if the directivity is, let's say, 20 dB and you want it to be 40 dB of directivity, I'm not talking about coupling coefficient, you can't change the coupling coefficient at your new frequency. That's a matter of the physical design. But you can always change the directivity. If the directivity is 20 dB, that's a 100 to 1 ratio, that means in the forward mode, the coupled line is picking up 1% of the energy that flows in the wrong direction that it shouldn't be responding to. Call that a leakage energy. 1% leakage energy is 20 dB of directivity. If you put a double stub tuner on the output of the directional coupler, you can create a second signal reflected off the double stub tuner that is also minus 20 dB. When you set the double stub tuner correctly, the second signal, 20 dB down, has exactly the right amplitude, but it's 180 degrees out of phase. It'll cancel the leakage signal that's being picked up by the auxiliary line. You can make the directivity one frequency at a time perfect by using a double stub tuner on the output port. Leave the double stub tuner there when you proceed with your additional readings, and you will now have as high a directivity as you're able to tune for. I wonder if you see the principle here as to how that works, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, absolutely, Dick. That's perfect. Well, you've been doing this, and I've been listening to you. I'm just doing a couple of calculations here, and I'm trying to see what kind of, attenuation you're going to have on the port, roughly. So, yeah, you're going to wind up something close in the HF band, somewhere around the minus 60 dB area. I'm just trying to figure out right now, just running the numbers real fast, if you had, you were trying to measure the return loss off of the reflected port, and what kind of signal you'd have there with the amount of directivity. Granted, you could probably swing that back a little bit, but I'm just saying usually if you have a 60 dB down port and 20 dB of directivity, that's not so good. Good, not terrible, I mean, for amateur use, but in other words, if you're really trying to, get a good number on VSWR and things. And it's an interesting point of something I have to look at. I know I've got a couple of microwave ones here. I'd like to actually measure them and see what they really do down there. Because I used to always basically like center all of my couplers around 30 dB and of coupling and with about 60 dB of directivity. But these kinds of numbers, yeah, I guess you can still probably get them to work, though, at least for amateur use anyway. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, you're being much too pessimistic. And you're thinking that the only directional coupler you can use is one that'll rectify enough voltage to move a Dawson-Val movement. You don't have to do that at all. If you started off with a 20 dB coupler that's rated for X-band, and down at 80 meters where you want to use it, it's a 60 decibel coupler. That means when you run a kilowatt, which is plus 60 dBm, on the straight through line, the coupled line will have 0 dBm, a milliwatt. If on that coupled line you're plugging it into a sensitive instrument, like a spectrum analyzer, and the spectrum analyzer can go down to a signal level of minus 110 dBm, your 0 dBm signal off of your coupled port is 110 dB above threshold of your spectrum analyzer. You'll have no trouble resolving it if you use the right instrumentation. In fact, if you actually did that experiment, a kilowatt transmitter, a 60 dB coupler, into a spectrum analyzer, your biggest problem is that the kilowatt signal flowing on the straight-through line, probably going to an antenna, is going to be radiated into space, come back into the shack, go through the shielding of the outer cabinet of your spectrum analyzer, and it may show up as a phony signal on the screen. So your shielding requirement becomes severe. But when it comes to sensitivity with a reasonable instrumentation, like another receiver that's well shielded or a spectrum analyzer, a 60 dB coupler is nothing to sneeze at. I wouldn't worry if it was an 80 dB coupler if I had the right sensing device. KT2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I guess it's, you know, it depends on a lot on, you know, how you're trying to measure and what I've, you know, how you've done in the past. I know what I used to do is basically start off with like a 30 dB coupler on a kilowatt signal and basically add another 30 dB of low power padding on the output of that port. So basically now I had a 1 watt signal, so that put, you know, 1 watt pad on the output of a 30 dB coupler isn't a big deal to get, you know, 1 milliwatt for a nice sensitive thermal head on an HP power meter. And then, of course, you know, on the reflected head, you don't really need many pads at all, because this way, you know, certainly you're hoping at least that your VSWR signal is going to be at least 30 dB less than your than your forward power. So it's always kind of nice to look at that. It's just, I guess I'm just kind of like running through everything on paper here just to get it all straight and see what actually happens when you're that far out and that much lower in frequency. But, yeah, I guess it does work. You know, I just never kind of looked at it that way. I usually always like to have numbers around the 30 dB mark just to make, I guess, the instrumentation easy.
Yeah, I've often used directional couplers in the 40, 50, 60 dB region, coupling coefficients for either the forward or reverse path. And as long as your instrumentation connected to that coupled path has enough sensitivity, that's no problem. And the nice thing about that kind of a low coupling coefficient is that 99.9% of the transmitter power is going through the main line of your coupler and going out the antenna. You're not wasting any of it, because the thing is going to be always following the laws of conservation of energy, and it's nice to have the majority of your power go to the right place, and only the sampling that you do is just enough to give you the information you want. You don't want to put a whole lot of power into your sampling function, where you're, in some cases, getting a watt of sampled power and you only want a milliwatt of it. You're wasting 999 milliwatts, if you know what I mean, there, Glenn. You didn't have to do it that way if you could have made a smaller coupling coefficient. And by the way, once you've got a coupler in your hand, if you want to modify, open up the case and modify it in such a way so that your 20 dB coupler becomes a 30 dB coupler, I bet you could handle that real easy. That's the easy direction to put a little bit of shielding in there. I bet you can envision how to do that one, Glenn. Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. I love the little Narda ones, too. Those are great because the way that those things were constructed, they were all put together with screws, and the strip line ran down the middle, and you had access to the coupling resistor. And when you send the coupling resistors inside, they're actually pretty good. I've modified quite a few of them myself to actually, you know, redo them, but there again, you know, there still is, like you're saying, the power limitations with the connectors and everything else. But no, they're actually very good. Every time I see a Narda one, one of the blue ones with the where it actually has the attenuation written on the top for both the coupled ports, I always try to grab them whenever I see them at a ham fest. I bet you too, Nick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You and me both. The blue Narda Type N directional couplers, which are strip line inside, with the red label that shows you the frequency response and gives you the coupling coefficient and the lower and upper frequency region on it, on the darn thing. Yeah. They're quite often at flea markets, very inexpensive, very handy to have. I never have enough of them. I keep buying the darn things. I recently was on a project where I needed a whole bunch of directional couplers. Let me think now. What number did I need? Exactly 3 dB. I needed 3 dB quadrature hybrids. That's a fancy way of saying a 3 dB coupling coefficient directional coupler. That's all it really is. And I had to run them at the kilowatt level. And I needed four of them for a particular project. And I ended up going to the Mecca company and buying them. And that's, by the way, the people who wrote this article that's in the February 2009 issue of Wireless and Design Development. It was written by the Mecca Electronics Incorporated, which I think that's a company in New Jersey. And there's a couple of minor math errors in the article. They tell you about the coupling coefficient is 10 log of power forward over power incident for a 10 dB coupler. However, the way they wrote down the mathematics, they meant to say log to the base 10. Well, the subscript of 10 for base 10 got raised up to the top, so therefore it became 10 log 10 times of open parentheses R1 over R2, if you know what I mean, close parentheses. So the base 10 of the log became a multiplier because the person didn't understand the notes of the guy who wrote the article at Mecca when he published it. And there's a couple of minor math errors like that. But other than that, the article does have some nice pictures, gives you some pretty good information. That combined with, as I said, this K5RMG.org article that I wrote will give you a lot of information. I worked out the mathematics. Let me drop. In the article in the K5RMG, I worked out the mathematics of what I did to use the X-band couplers that were rated for a couple of watts that were in the tool crib at my company and used them at the 300-watt level, and they ran ice cold because I was doing such lower frequency compared to what was rated. No problem. That explained. I also go through the mathematics of what I did to increase the directivity and accuracy of a directional coupler measurement. If I'm using a directional coupler and I want to be able to resolve standing wave ratio down to a very small number, I go through the mathematics of what you do to a ordinary performance coupler to make that happen so that you can then make that measurement, or how to resolve the measurement, how to get rid of the ambiguity, and so on. So that's all covered in that article. You may get a kick out of it. Some people have. Anybody with any further questions or comments on the subject of directional couplers, that's the subject on the floor right now, give me your call letters and name, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2OJO.
Okay, K-E-Y and O-J-O in that order. K2KEY first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Years ago when I got interested in working with equipment up here in the VHF-UHF, I needed something to measure the line and something that cost, that didn't cost very much money. I think the way my life has always been with amateur radio comes last, of course, financially. And in the VHF manual at that time, the ARRL VHF manual, they had a very simple way of putting together a differential coupler. And I should say directional coupler, differential, directional coupler. And it was by a fellow by the name of Tom, W1SL. And basically, he made it so simple that you just use a pipe fitting, a pipe key fitting, where you have the port in and out on each end, and the probe goes in the center of the pipe. How he put that together, very, very easy. If you want to experiment, make your own, and see how it works and all. It only requires a few very simple parts that many people either have around and get easily at a plumbing supply. So it's W1SL. He called a line sampler, actually. That's the way he referred to it, Dick. Over.
Yeah, that was Tom McMullen, ARRL headquarters. He was in the laboratory at the time. He was using 3/4-inch water pipe fittings. And in order to make what he called power samplers, line samplers, and they really were beautiful directional couplers with very inexpensive materials. I was at ARRL headquarters when Tom McMullen was working on that article. It was during one of my visits when I was showing them my parallel kilowatt amplifier, which they published. I think OJO is Howard, and Howard, you've got a very famous name. Mr. OJO, if I got the right prefix, KC2OJO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, you have the right name, Howard. Dick, I was wondering, you know, the counter-directional coupler is very interesting in terms of its simplicity and the counter-coupling of the capacitive and magnetic fields. Your comment, though, was very interesting, but I don't know if you followed it down enough. By selecting the resistance on the two ends is how you really adjust it to be directional, as I understand it, to get the right ratio so they cancel. But could you say a few more words about the way the resistance might go, depending on whether the capacitance is more powerful or the magnetic field is a more powerful effect? And does that change at all with frequency? It sounds as though it didn't. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, good set of questions, Howard. The good news is that when you set the terminating resistors correctly on the auxiliary line, and you're setting those resistors in order to get directivity. Once you tune that for directivity, assuming your resistor is a pure resistor versus frequency, it is a broadband response. It's hard to believe. And I was a little bit too simplistic when I say you're adjusting the right ratio of the capacitive coupling versus the inductive coupling. What I said is true, and which way they go as you change the resistance, I'll admit, is not clear. If you read Holland Howe's book called Strip Line Techniques, he gives you a lot of the mathematics of this. Reference data for radio engineers will give it to you. If you Google the word directional coupler in Wikipedia, I'm pretty sure they'll give it to you. What's really going on is called Z-odd and Z-even. In other words, your main line and your auxiliary line have a certain relationship, which is a function of their physical positioning. They have a certain ratio of odd impedance to even impedance. When you make that ratio right, you get directivity. And under ordinary circumstances, you and I would design a directional coupler where the straight through line, the main line, is 50 ohms, and the auxiliary line is also 50 ohms. But it turns out for the auxiliary line, particularly if you're going into, let's say, a diode rectifier, because you're going to use it as a standing wave ratio bridge, under those circumstances, there's nothing magic. Let me drop. There's nothing magic about the auxiliary line being a 50 ohm impedance. Whether you made it a 100 ohm or a 10 ohm impedance, as long as you properly terminate it, it will give you the directivity you want. Now, the line itself, because of its proximity to the main line, if I understand correctly what's going on when you adjust a mono match, or if you go to the ARL antenna book and you look at that homebrew version of a standing wave ratio bridge built with toroid transformers, when you have the right terminating resistor, you automatically get directivity. And you're about to ask me, as I make that terminating resistor higher or lower, am I favoring the capacitive effect or the magnetic effect? I am guessing right now, and I'm not positive on this, I'm Howard, that the resistor going up and down mostly moves the capacitive effect. The inductive effect is a transformer effect, and I think it doesn't care what terminating resistor per se, whereas the capacitive effect is quite sensitive. So I think you're taking the capacitive effect up and down as you make the terminating resistor higher and lower. I believe that's what's going on. But believe it or not, no matter what impedance you've got for the auxiliary line, no matter where it's located in the transmission line circuit, where it's got some coupling to the main transmission line center conductor, in almost every case, there's a magic terminating resistor on both ends, which will give you the directivity you want. I'm pretty sure that's always true. At least it has always been true in the crazy setups that I've always tried. So it's not as difficult to achieve the directivity as you think when you're doing it as an empirical experiment. As a calculation, knowing all of the mathematics of what's going on with Z-odd and Z-even, unless you've got a very good modeling program, that approach will strike you as a very difficult way to go. Whereas a little bit of experimenting, you'll find the answer real fast. It's a little bit like a blind man walking up a hill. Your feet will tell you which way is uphill. You have no trouble going uphill, even though you're blindfolded. KC2, OJO, KQIW, and the TechNet.
You're right. That's a very surprising answer to me, that it's really not frequency sensitive. But it also makes sense that if you basically have a couple of resistance boxes, you're not feeding points far away from where your coupler is, the counter-directional coupler. You basically just adjust the resistors until you get to the point that your directionality peaks as best you can. And I take it the resistors are then balanced at both sides. Over to you,
sir. Yes, they do. And the reason why you balance the resistor on both sides is that there's a magic resistor that's identical on both sides and it terminates the auxiliary line. And when you get that, you achieve directivity. And let's assume now that I've got 100 watts flowing from left to right on the main line of my coax structure. And if it's a 20 dB